KALW.
The first one is to acknowledge that a harm has been done. The second is to apologize for that harm.
Reparations for descendants of enslaved people isn't all about direct cash payments.
For the first time in the nation, we have a series of bills that are going to the governor's desk that provides reparations for African Americans.
Today, how states can begin to repair fractured histories around slavery. Then local experts weigh in on Kamala Harris's track record as a prosecutor.
What are the ways that we can champion criminal justice reform efforts down the ballot in ways that could activate this demographic?
And we consider the power of Black immigrant voters.
If you are not organized, you don't have the power.
Diverse Black voices and the election. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Election Day is 8 days away, and Black voters remain a pivotal demographic in this election, but the landscape is shifting. Today, we're going to explore issues that Black voters care about. We'll hear some local Black voices in politics, and we'll dig into the power of the Black immigrant vote. To start off, California might soon make some of the first steps in the country towards reparations for descendants of enslaved people. It's a process that's been going on since 2020, when Governor Newsom appointed a task force to study reparations. Our friends at Cap Radio bring us this report from Megan Myskowski about how lawmakers are tackling some of the complications coming up regarding reparations and the stakes for California and the nation.
It's a hot morning on the Capitol lawn, and several advocacy groups are kicking off their next big push, a campaign for a November ballot measure. Carmen Nicole Cox with the ACLU California Action speaks to the crowd.
Slavery is inconsistent with California values.
That's right.
And even still, slavery is alive and well in detention and penal facilities across our great state.
This is a rally in favor of Prop 6, which would end forced labor in state prisons. It was part of a successful suite of reparations bills. Two failed bills that would have helped advance the state's reparations plan are also grabbing attention, and Cox says voters are watching.
We absolutely vote people in because we believe that they are going to advance certain policy. And then when they show us that they won't, we get to vote again.
California lawmakers are making big moves towards pulling off first-in-the-country reparations policies. But not everyone agrees on how to get there. The state responded to protests and calls for racial justice in 2020 with a reparations task force. And last year, that group came back with an over 1,000-page report. Secretary of State Shirley Weber initiated that work. She said when the report came out that she believes California could make moves that other states and even the federal government can't.
This effort had been tried many times at the federal level, but because of the complexity of the politics of this nation and its resistance to any kind of change or activity with regards to African Americans, it had failed many times.
The California Legislative Black Caucus released a list of priority bills based on the report back in January. Riverside Democratic Assembly member Corey Jackson is a member of the Black Caucus, and he says he's proud of how many of those bills succeeded.
For the first time in the nation, we have a series of bills that are going to the governor's desk that provides reparations for African Americans.
8 of the 14 bills passed. One calls for the state to make an official apology for its role in slavery. Another mandates it investigate claims of stolen property via eminent domain. The bills touch on a lot of things, including education, health, and criminal justice. Jackson says that might not be what people expect. The package doesn't include direct cash payments, but it is in line with the steps the task force laid out.
The first one is to acknowledge that a harm has been done. The second is to apologize for that harm.
He said these bills put those ideas in motion, and that's a big win. But there is tension in what passed and what didn't. Two bills that were introduced later failed at the last minute. One would have established a new government department to carry out reparations laws, and another would create a reparations fund, but not with money from the state. Jackson says that although those steps are in the report, the caucus wanted to move more gradually. Gardena State Senator Stephen Bradford is also a member of the Black Caucus and one of two lawmakers who served on the task force. He sponsored the two bills.
I think they were critically important to the overall movement of reparations and being able to do something concrete right now.
Bradford says other states are looking to California as a model.
There are going to be those critics who are already talking that says, hey, a state as so-called progressive as California can get it done. How are you going to get it done in some of the more conservative states?
It's his last year in the Senate, and Bradford says he wants to leave a workable roadmap behind.
Reporter Megan Mykowski brought us that story from our friends at CAP Radio News. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. As we get closer to November 5th, polls show this remains a tight presidential race. Every vote is critical, and both major campaigns are seeking the votes of Black Americans. But there are deep conversations happening right now within Black America around whether or not to support Kamala Harris. To dig into all this, we invited a panel of Black political experts to our live event space at 220 Montgomery in San Francisco. I was joined by Pastor Michael McBride, Executive Director of Live Free USA, Amy Allison, Founder and President of She the People, and USF Political Science Professor James Lance Taylor. Here is part of our conversation.
I want to play this clip from this interview I conducted with Kamala Harris back in 2009. Yes, I was at KLW still in 2009, way back when, yeah. When she was the DA of San Francisco and she was running to be the Attorney General. And I asked her about this idea that's coming up today, 15 years later, this idea of being a progressive prosecutor and being criticized for that. And some saw her as hard on crime here in San Francisco. Others saw her as soft on crime. She came out with this book called Smart on Crime at the time. And she, as she tries to appeal today to folks, you know, on the right or in the middle, toughening up her rhetoric at times, she's also got to make sure the left isn't alienated. And I think this clip is relevant to today. If we can play clip three.
You said that we need to remove politics from the issue of public safety. It can't be a Democratic and Republican issue, as you're mentioning right now. It's tough for some issues to not become politicized. How can you remove politics from the issue of public safety when you're Attorney General?
First of all, I think that there are certainly some issues that are partisan and others that are bipartisan, but crime and the issue of public safety is a nonpartisan issue. And, you know, I've never heard of a criminal approaching his victim and asking what party are they affiliated with before they commit the crime. Everyone is concerned about living in a safe community. Everyone wants to live in a safer community. Everyone wants law enforcement. And so it is not a partisan issue. And frankly, as I travel the state these days, I'll tell you that approaching longstanding problems and issues through an ideological lens is just not working.
So that was then D.A. Harris in San Francisco. Today, it feels like Vice President Harris is trying to walk that fine line, trying to win over both sides and trying to just walk that line. And so, Amy, fast forward to today, how do you think she's doing in terms of walking that line? You know, progressive prosecutor, hard on crime, smart on crime. Black folks saying she put us in jail, just like all of it coming. How do you think she's doing?
Her prosecutor message is playing well with women of color. I mean, it is. And we polled it. I think her explanation of why she became a prosecutor. A lot of us heard when she reintroduced herself as a presidential candidate around issues of women and girls being victims was something that affected and people have a lot of, they can really relate to. And she's right. Way back when she's saying that people want to feel safe. I live in Oakland. I want to feel safe. And I want the police to serve the community. I don't want people, the police abusing the community. And that is also something that that is part of that we're dealing with. I mean, I think part of what we know that motivates voters is dealing with police accountability, which is something that, Pastor Mike works on every day. We know that that issue is particularly salient for young Black men in terms of, voting. I also think that in terms of what's motivating people, it is more motivating for someone right now, just, not to get off of the issue of crime, but it's more motivating for Black women, younger Black women, to talk about the issues that we'd mention than to talk about a prosecutorial record of Kamala Harris, the old prosecutorial record. So I guess what I'm saying is when we look at the number of weeks to the election and what are the salient points, I think more and more Black, particularly Black women, but Black people are accepting the fact that her smart on crime and her prosecutor record actually qualifies her to stand up against a guy like Trump. Trump's a felon. And people will talk about what, he should be talked about in the way that he's multiple felonies. He's been found guilty of crimes and abusing women. He's been impeached twice. And so I think in contradiction to that and running against that, her record as a prosecutor, her record as attorney general has become even more respected and accepted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I agree.
Pastor Mike, this is your space. What do you have to say?
Well, I think that it's tough to hear that when we still are seeing Black people be abused by police. And again, no one seems to be able to stop it. So I think that it's really important to acknowledge that everyone doesn't want police. Everyone wants safety. Some people want police, and that may be like a lot of people, but it's not everyone. And the question is, in an election, obviously we have 30 days, is any of the messaging going to change? Probably not, right? But if we're talking about the margins, like how much enthusiasm can we activate and garner in some of these swing states? And if we're talking about, never voters versus non-voters versus, then I think you are going to have to slice some of this down, right? Mm-hmm. And some people are just going to be a casualty of, I think, just a very short runway to the campaign. Mm-hmm. What I want to actually, invite us to think about is several things. Number one, what are the ways that we can champion criminal justice reform efforts down the ballot in ways that could potentially activate this demographic of voters who then may vote up the ballot, right? So mm-hmm. slavery being removed from the Constitution in the state of California is on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
That issue alone.
Again, because it lost last time.
Yes.
And people don't know that.
Yeah, yeah, and it's polling to lose this time.
People don't right. believe that. California had slavery on the ballot last time and lost.
Right.
And now it was about five other states too.
Absolutely.
And now it's coming back up.
And so I think that it is tough for me to hear that the criminal prosecutor narrative is winning, a winning message for folks, because it just reminds me every day that we still, in a country where one-third of the country are folks with criminal convictions, that we still don't find it compelling to not play into a narrative that, in people's imagination, when you use that trope, you're actually reinforcing a criminalization framework on a number of individuals who do not have political champions. I do believe Kamala Harris has been the vanguard for progressive prosecutors. People tried to hold Kamala Harris accountable for being a progressive prosecutor by today's standard. But when she was the prosecutor, she was the first black woman prosecutor, certainly in the state of California, I think in the country. Yeah. The things she did in her office and the people that worked in her office, some of who are now my friends, Latifah Simon, and a whole host of other folks I can name drop, they helped to craft a whole different use of that office to try and use diversion. One of her main focuses were locking up pimps and sexual predators and other folks. So the young people who have been fed propaganda about her record were not even alive back then. I'm 48 years old. I'm from here. Nobody here thought that she was hard on crime. She actually did not have the endorsement of the police union, right? Of the prosecutors union at every level of her electoral career.
That was an excerpt from our panel, Black Voices and the Election, at our live event space at 220 Montgomery in San Francisco. I was joined by Pastor Michael McBride of Live Free USA, Amy Allison of She the People, and USF political science professor James Lance Taylor. We talked about a whole lot more, and we'll have a link to our entire conversation at klw.org/2024elections. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. A conversation about the Black vote wouldn't be complete if we didn't talk about the diaspora. The Bay Area's Black immigrant population grew by 55% in the last decade, from 36,000 people in 2010 to over 55,000 in 2020. And data shows that more than half of Black immigrants overall are naturalized citizens with the right to vote. But do these growing numbers translate to growing political power? We held another panel in our live event space where we explored the power of immigrant community voters. One of the panelists was Olugbeme Oluwale, CEO of Oakland Global Enterprises. He's a criminal justice consultant and a community activist. In this excerpt from the panel, he shares how he became politically engaged after immigrating to the Bay Area.
When I first came to this country, I was just here to go to school and go back home. Most of us at the time, that's what we wanted to do. But then after graduation, you were ready to go home. Then the folks at home who sent you here, who supported you, are saying, oh, don't come yet. The country is not in good hands. Nigeria, particularly where I'm from, at the time, in the 70s and early 80s, was going through several military coups. And you know, military coup is a dictatorship. So I decided, hey, in order to go back there and help change the system, I have to know a little bit about government. I have to know a little bit about criminal justice, because in order to be a good governor or a good administrator, you must be able to dispense justice fairly. So I went to school. My first degree was in government with concentration on international relations. So I decided, okay, let me marry that with criminal justice. So I went to San Jose State University and got my master's in criminal justice administration. I started to work in the field by running halfway houses. While I was doing that, at the same time, I realized that I'm from Nigeria. I have to also be involved in politics, in cultural development of our people. So I started cultural and musical entertainment. And that's when I met Emmanuel Nadeau. He was very supportive in terms of whenever I had a show, a concert, he would help me advertise it on his radio show. That was a long time ago. However, I realized that we Africans living here are not quite politically engaged. It's almost like we are complacent. We are timid. We forget that, hey, they call us immigrants. We are citizens of this nation, like everybody else. Who is not an immigrant in this country, except for the indigenous people? Okay? So when they say you are an immigrant, yeah, okay, I'm an immigrant, but I have attained citizenship. I have the right to vote. Then you need to vote. Because voting, your vote is your power. Your vote is your statement that I belong. I'm part of this society. And I'm ready to participate in the determination of my life. I'm not going to let you decide how my life's going to be, what I should accept, what I shouldn't accept. But the handicap that we Africans have, and I'm using the word Africans because folks think we are the same. We are not the same. We Africans are different peoples based on the fact that other forces colonized us. You have British Africans, you have French Africans, you have Portuguese Africans, you have Dutch Africans from South Africa, you have Italian Africans. And those orientations kind of separate us, because the French has a way that he was indoctrinated. The British have a way that we are indoctrinated. And it's affecting us here in the United States. We see each other right here. There are Ghanaian brothers. There are Nigerian brothers. And people from Tanzania. Okay. But
Ivory Coast.
But when we are talking about working together, it's difficult. And that is why you don't hear all these candidates rushing to us to say we want to cut your support. So we need to start to organize. That's the key word, organize. When you organize, you're speaking with one voice. You can pick any proposition, any measure that is on the table locally. If you are not organized, you don't have the power to make change. And what do we bring to the table? We bring numbers, our population. We bring our education. We bring our economic power. For instance, I live in Oakland. I looked up the data for Oakland. Oakland, this 2024, has a population of 435,000 to 436. I looked up how many Nigerians are living in Oakland. The data showed me 3,000, which translates to 0.057% of the population. That is quite a substantial number. If we organize, if we come together, that population power that we have, and a lot of Nigerians are very educated, so they can understand the political process. They can understand the issues that are on the table, how it affects their lives, their children. For instance, there are common issues that bind us together with other communities, immigrant communities. We're talking about affordable housing, affordable health care, education. We're talking about right to abortion. All those things we all share in common. So we can leverage our statistics, power that we have, and work with other immigrant organizations. When we do work with other immigrant communities, we are enlarging our power and the ability to make a change. So this critical election is very, very important. We are already being castigated as robbers, criminals, eating dogs and cats and whatnot, even though my favorite is lobster and steak.
That was Olugbeme Oluele, a criminal justice consultant and a community activist, speaking at KALW's live panel on the power of immigrant community voters. We'll have a link to the entire conversation from that night at kalw.org/2024elections. Today's Cross Currents team includes Yosmai Del Maso, Anthony Ivey, Aaron Lim, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salier, Shirin Adil, Hanisha Herjani, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.